Talk given Sunday, 7th January, 1979. Those of you who were present for our last meeting in November may recall that we considered that one way of understanding the purpose of our existence as members of the human race could be expressed in the terms of realization of the eternal silence. Now, the subject is a very deep and a profound subject, and we touched upon it during the meetings in November. Today, let us consider together, very quietly, with the brain and the psyche, very, very quiet and peaceful, certain deep points which are intimately related to that statement, the realization of the eternal silence and its implications for us in terms of understanding the more difficult aspects of scriptural teaching. When we read the scriptures, we think we have understood. What we have actually done is to interpret those words according to the contents of our own psyche, which we commonly miscall the mind. In terms of the mind, there'd be no difficulty, because mind is that universal archetypal expression of creative energy which is characterless, all-pervading, but which is the power which releases cosmos out of chaos, and which, insofar as it functions in us individual human beings, is the meaning of the word intelligence, which we can put in another form, namely that intelligence is the ability to see the fact as the fact without the distorting effect of our beliefs, convictions, our limited experience, all our conditioning, and all that which Buddhism, for instance, calls the defilements of the mind. The manojnana, the pure manas, the pure mind, which is part of, as in other religions, the divine essence. The Jews have called it neshama, the Zarathustrians have called it pravashi, the Hindus and the Upanishadic teachings have their own word. Well, of course, manas is the Sanskrit term, the Hindu-Buddhist term, and so on. But all religions have taught this, and it is extremely difficult to differentiate between the workings of pure mind the nous of Plato, the buddhi, as spoken of in India, you see, unerring insight. It is extremely difficult to distinguish the workings of that from the workings of our psyche. So now, let us try to understand, or let me put it this way first. Let us try to enter into the deeps, into very deep waters, without drowning. That is why I suggest, let the psyche and the brain be quiet. It will be active, the brain must necessarily be active if we are attending and listening to words. We can't avoid that. But let it be free of chattering back at the words you hear. See? Now, to start with, there can be no perception of our own body or of any other body or any material object without the functioning of our senses coupled with the use of our faculty of speech. Because that which the senses convey to us is constantly named by us. We look at something and say, oh, that is a horse, or that is a man, or that is a flower, and so on. So it has to be named by us. And the naming implies that the mental constructs we have in our own psyche, like a mental card index, immediately tell us the object or person we are looking at, or meeting, or whatever it be. So, the functioning of the senses and the faculty of speech makes us aware of our own body. Now, we must note a very important difference between the modern world's outlook and the old world's outlook. In the modern world, the tendency for the world population is to regard matter as existing in its own right, the ultimate source, the ultimate substance, which in the process of evolution and development, in becoming animals and in becoming human beings, releases life, mind and consciousness. Now, the old world looked at it in a totally different way. The old world regarded consciousness as the ultimate, and all else as the constituents of consciousness. The body itself, therefore, is not regarded as a material substance existing in its own rights. It is not that consciousness comes afterwards. Consciousness precedes everything. The mind precedes everything. That is to say, that energy which is mind, pure mind, in the process of concretization, which is the expression of its releasing cosmos out of chaos, ultimately produces all that is what we commonly call material. That was the old viewpoint. Now, this body of ours is a psychophysical organism. The psyche is not something immaterial. it is rooted in the physical body. Minus brain, nerves, ductless glands, and so forth, there'd be no such thing as mental, what we commonly call the mental processes, the psychical phenomena which we human beings display. Our thoughts, our feelings, our intellectual and emotional activities, and so forth. We must bear this in mind very carefully. Because if we don't bear it in mind carefully, we will evaluate the body in the wrong way if we are seriously concerned with living the religious life, which is indeed, in the true sense, the human life. And the human life in fulfillment and perfection is the godly life, the divine life. Because when we talk of divinity or God, we are apotheosizing all that we understand and have experienced as life-promoting, furthering the purposes of the great life trends through the world. We apotheosize all that and project a picture out of our brains which we call God. Now it's important to realize this, because if we do see it clearly, this unhappy separation in the mind of mankind, that God, the Creator, the Absolute, the power that brings everything into being, is a something totally and permanently other than myself. At present, I have exiled myself. I have excommunicated myself from the totality, from transcendence. But this body, your body, all material things are transcendence embodied. They are the concretest expression of the one primordial creative energy acting in eternity. We are conscious only in terms of time, space, matter. So, because we are so limited, and because we as we are only too much aware of the drives we have inherited out of our animal evolution, and we have our own particular desires, particular ambitions, which are in conflict in some degree or other with the desires and ambitions and pursuits of practically all other human beings, we obtrude ourself upon the world. This obtrusion of the self is something which is very distinctive of the human species. It is difficult to find any living species which obtrudes itself in the manner in which man does. It is man who affirms, I am I. And in that affirmation is involved the statement, although he may not say it, I am I, but not you. And in saying, I am I, but not you, he means, although he may deny it intellectually, he actually means that he is not in full relationship with you. Therefore, the suffering, the misery, the conflict, the confusion and disorder in the world. This is one of the profound meanings of dukkha, the word dukkha in the real sense, which is a Hindu-Buddhistic term. Its literal meaning is far from the infinite. And when we say infinite, or the immeasurable. We are talking of that which is transcendent. But all this which is limited is completely subsumed in the totality, in transcendence. We are conscious in terms of the separation. As and when the individual's consciousness has undergone the right transformation, the complete transformation, then he is conscious, no longer conscious, in terms of isolative, separative self-consciousness. He is awake to the totality. That does not mean he is unawake to himself, far from it. He knows himself exactly as he is, and he is awake to totality as a whole. So he thinks not in terms of, he actually functions therefore, not in terms of self against not self. He functions in terms of complete cooperation spontaneously and naturally with the whole developmental process of the human species. This is not easy to bear in mind as a matter of course. We think this thing out. Now, that which is thought out, hammered out like that, is a ghost of the reflection of the truth. And it is therefore as impotent as that ghost. But we, being ignorant creatures, are frightened of ghosts. And it is that fear which spoils the story of our religious living, our spiritual development, our human fulfillment. So bear this carefully in mind. We obtrude ourselves upon the harmony of the cosmos. Harmony not to be understood in our petty little limited way of pleasant sounds only, not at all. Harmony is the overriding term which includes what we call concords as well as discords, which includes the constructive processes as well as what we call the destructive processes. Includes them, integrates them, transcends them. That is the meaning of harmony and of universal harmony. All right. So, for us, where we are concerned, we cannot hear the silence of eternity. The silence of eternity is the song of life. That silence is not the opposite of sound, not the opposite of noise. Whether the sound is pleasant or not pleasant, this silence includes all that sound. The sort of sound we make, of course you will appreciate the word sound is used metaphorically really, the sort of sound we make depends fundamentally upon the state of our consciousness, the inner consciousness, which we do not know with our brain. The surface activity, superficial activity of the brain does not convey to us how we are, the manner in which we are conscious of existence, the totality of existence. But this consciousness in us is the hidden secret, immortal, eternal, determining power functioning through us. If it is eternal and immortal, as indeed it is, then that means that consciousness must not be understood as my consciousness. something which is specific to the living person as such. There is that aspect of consciousness in us which is the commonly functioning aspect through our daily lives, namely discriminative consciousness. What the Buddhists call vijnana, but the Upanishads have a different meaning of vijnana. Vijnana in the Upanishadic teachings means that universal active mind awareness which is a universal light, which is a universal flame, but which manifests through every individual. And the individual, because of his ignorance, his lack of vision, thinks of that in terms of his property, that there is a bit of it inside him. You can't have a bit of the immortal or the eternal. You see? It is this bittiness in our lives, this disjointedness, this fragmentariness, which is the source of all the ill and misery of the world, the state of sin of the world. When I say the world, I mean particularly the human race. The rest of the world is unconsciously in communion with totality. It is we who throw ourselves, we excommunicate ourselves. Therefore, we cannot hear the silence of eternity, which is the song of life. Now, this is due, of course, to the intrusion of ourself upon the whole. And when we say the intrusion of ourself, of course we exist physically as a particular finite manifestation of the totality. We exist in such forms that there can be distinctions. This is John Smith, that is William Brown, etc., etc. We can distinguish that. But in awareness, in consciousness, we stop there, instead of being awake to the fact that this is integral part and parcel of this irrefragable totality. So it is a case of the intrusion by our selfness onto totality. Now, if we understand that, we will understand that people who talk in terms of destroying the ego are using misleading terms. There is nothing that is destroyed. The self, in either a little sense or a big sense, is not destroyed. What we have to do is to rightly relate this which we call myself or yourself or himself or whatever it is, to relate that rightly to the context of the whole, the totality. That is to say, relate it not merely as a matter of thinking it out intellectually, but of being fully awake to it, being intensely aware of it, so that we naturally function cooperatively. We can't help it. How do you think all the so-called distinct organs of the body function? Quite naturally, spontaneously, they function in cooperation with each other. The heart doesn't say, look, I've had enough of this liver and kidneys, I'm not going to cooperate with you anymore, I'm going to stop beating. Well, it's the end of poor old kidneys and liver and the whole person, in fact, isn't it? It's somewhat like that. So it is this selfness, this egoism, which we have to be free of. You have heard this sort of thing again and again. But have we really bitten into it, got our teeth into it, as we say? Because if we have, then life is totally different for us and for our environment. Because consciousness, in its supreme sense, in its real sense, is something universal. Insofar as the individual's inner consciousness awakes and flowers out into this capacity to be inclusive of the totality, the consciousness of all mankind, of the entire universe, is transformed. That is something we don't know. But the perfected holy ones of the past knew it. They knew it so well that they made no mistake as regards the teachings they gave out. You see, they made no mistake whatsoever. It is we, ignorant mortals, coming after them, who organized or tried to organize their teaching and fit them into limited intellectual molds, and then had the audacity to declare, "This is the final truth." And look at the sorrow and suffering of mankind in consequence. 's extraordinary, isn't it? So now, silence is the complete ending of the intrusion by selfness into totality. Now, this separate self-consciousness which we have, which makes us say, "I am I," and keeps us blind to the fact that of the unity of the totality, which is born of our sense perception of body, is tied up, that is to say, is limited, confined by our what we call space-time matter consciousness. Space-time and matter come out simultaneously into existence. Without appearing to be flippant, one may say that the primordial Big Bang, when consciousness exploded like that suddenly, produced space-time matter all at once. Take any one of those three away and everything vanishes altogether. But in doing that, what happened? Space-time matter, each of them and all of them, confined consciousness. The all-pervading, undifferentiated consciousness, which is the all-pervading, undifferentiated, primordial creative energy acting in eternity. Now, I've used the word eternity quite a few times already. What do we mean by eternity? You look into the dictionary or you talk with anybody and he thinks of eternity as time going on forever and ever. That is not the meaning of eternity. That is our distorted understanding. I should strictly call it our misunderstanding of eternity. At the same time, eternity is not the opposite of time. There are others who will say timelessness is eternity. Is it? Is the experience of timelessness, and there are those who have experienced timelessness, and a great many people, not merely the perfected holy ones, who have experienced timelessness. There are a great many people who have experienced timelessness, and they say, mistakenly, it's a good thing they are not here, otherwise they might not be happy with me, they say mistakenly, this was the experience of eternity. And then, when you question further, or if they are willing to talk further, they will say, oh, it was when I was taken up into that, wrapped beyond the senses and taken up into that profound condition, etc., etc. They experienced timelessness, true, but they say for that period of time. Or they write and talk in terms of during those moments of timelessness. But a moment means time. And if you experience something just for a period, then that timelessness is not exactly the real timelessness. So neither time nor timelessness are the opposites of eternity, nor is timelessness alone eternity. Both time and timelessness are completely subsumed in eternity. Eternity is and will everlastingly remain the unknown and unknowable by any intellectual process in which the brain is involved. That is to say, if the brain is influencing the conceptualizing of eternity, it is not eternity. It remains the unknown, and it is the unknowable, but it is experienceable. You remember the Buddha saying, using the word shunyata phala samadhi, when he's talking to Agivesana, who has come to question him about various things. And he talks of entering in and remaining in that sunyata phala samadhi, and he goes on to say, in which I constantly abide. Now he has to talk like that. He has to say, I abide. And one thinks, ah, here is a person, one person who is abiding in eternity. It's not like that. When a Buddha has come to that extraordinarily felicitous consummation of human fulfillment, which is the real Buddhahood, it is not he who abides in eternity. It is eternity manifesting the nature of eternity through that abiding in shunyata phala samadhi. This is where so many of the mystics of the world and the great religious teachers have misrepresented in words that which happens. I do not claim for a single moment that what I have said is the truth, far from it. But I have attempted to put into words which perhaps are ever so slightly less misleading than the words that have come down to us through the ages. We must get hold of this, really get hold of it. First, we will see it only with our brains and with the intellect. Then we will get the feel of it. But both these are absolutely not merely kindergarten, but almost prenatal states. Then when we are born into it by the living experience, and then we have to remain, we can't go back into the mother's womb, you see. If we live by it, and the living becomes natural, spontaneous, and has its own constancy, then truly eternity and immortality are realized through you, the finite living psychophysical organism. You or I, as John Smith or Firoz Mehta or Mary Brown or whoever it is, you see, we do not achieve, attain, realize, fulfill a goal, fulfill a purpose, all that is egoistic stuff and nonsense. Nothing of that sort happens. I never enter the kingdom of heaven or enter nirvana or any such thing like that. It is the transcendent, the eternal, the immortal, the absolute, which displays its unimaginable beauty and splendor through the individual who has become the totally unresisting Holy Grail, the vehicle through which the transcendence manifests in this particular way. See, then there is no conflict between conceit and pride on the one hand and modesty and humility on the other. None at all. You are free of that psychical, that ambivalent psychical conflict. And that is only the early stage. So now, so much for eternity. Now, if, and it's a very big if, attentiveness, complete, total attentiveness, the samadhi, the true samadhi condition, the sat-chit ananda of the Upanishad, the chit aspect, which is attentiveness, pure attentiveness. If attentiveness and observation, not in the sense of I an observing subject, observing the observed object, but just pure observation, like the smile on the face of the Cheshire cat, you know, then there was only the smile and no cat and no nothing. When I am like that, this person is like that, I have fulfilled my no-thingness. There is the complete realization that I am no thing. If you like, nothing. When that is there, naturally, spontaneously, as a matter of course, then you are truly observant, truly mindful. Mindfulness has come to its fulfillment in the perfect samadhi, the perfect communion, to use a theistic word. Now, if attentiveness and observation, which means therefore the state of being completely awakened, the observation of things and persons, of essences and principles, dharmas, as Mahayana Buddhism calls them, and also that which is beyond both of these, if attentiveness and observation can be total and constant, then awareness can be whole, total awareness. Therefore, we can really appreciate that statement, not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it. He doesn't know it in the way that you and I know that a sparrow has fallen to the ground when we see it falling. Not in that manner. In a totally different manner. I can't possibly begin to describe that manner. Because at that depth, that intensity of consciousness and awakenedness, there is no description possible. All description is analytical. These things are nondescript. What words I try to use for the nondescript are words which perhaps may strike an answering note in harmony with the reality. You won't know that it has struck. I won't know that it has been evoked. But reality, the truth, the absolute, knows it. The Father in heaven, which is a mode of talking about it, knows it. And do remember that when Jesus said Father in heaven, he did not mean what the whole Christian world imagines it means. Abba, Father, Abba, Ba, the Son of the primordial origin, the absolute origin of all things, the En Sof, as put in the Kabbalah. You see, that's the Father. And heaven is associated with wisdom, Chochmah, the divine primordial wisdom, mind, God the All-Father mind of the Hermetic Trismegistic writings, and so forth. That's the Father in heaven. Now, these are somewhat deep waters, but don't be afraid. These are waters in which we cannot drown. We can swim perfectly happily in these waters without drowning, without being hurt. But we become purified in our inner depths. And if we can respond to it, that is all. Not react to it. That is to say, not say, ah, this is marvelous, I'll have it. Or this is, oh, this is nonsense, I'll reject it. If you do neither of those things, then the great mystery will take place, the mystery of transformation, the mystery which is expressed in phrases like the baptism by water and the baptism by fire takes place in the inner depths. And we have to let it happen and not care whether it has happened or not. Transcendence knows, I don't. Now, when awareness is whole like that, it is the immortal, it is the eternal. This is nirvana, the real meaning of nirvana. Devoid of a vehicle, burnt up. That's one of the meanings of nirvana, burnt up, faded away. In the Subala Upanishad, when the sage asks the question of the teacher, the sage asks, what happens to the vijnana gana, meaning the cognition mass. Of course, all these translations are difficult. They are somehow or other somewhere misleading. One may use the word the omniscience of the divine. What happens when that goes through the process of its ultimate liberation? And the teacher answers, it first burns up body, material, the psyche, the intellect, everything that you can name, everything that appears to be concrete or subtle or subtler, right up to the subtlest stage, and so forth. And then he goes on to say, it burns up the imperishable. It's the most extraordinary thing to say. It burns up the infinite. And then it ends up by saying, and then death becomes one with the Lord. This is the teaching of nirvana. Yea, this is the teaching of the Vedas. It's in the Subala Upanishad. It takes decades of meditation to understand the tremendous significance and depth of just three or four paragraphs, short paragraphs of that sort. You see, it indicates the process of transformation and also associated with of intensification of consciousness until it reaches those supreme states. Then the perfected Holy One, returning to ordinary everyday consciousness in terms of his sense life and his discursive, intellectual, brain life and so forth, he just lives holiness. He's the living embodiment of that holiness, that wholeness. He is the incarnation of the divine. These are realities. These are not wishful projections out of an unfulfilled heart or mind. When we see this, our worldly values, however sublime and noble they may be, however petty and stupid they may be, every one of them completely vanishes. Because in the presence, in the actuality of the eternal, the immortal, what meaning is there for values, for purpose, for fulfillment, for fruition? All that belongs to the process, to the developmental process of the cosmos as exemplified in the human kingdom. See? So all of them completely vanish. And then there is no thing left. But the living person there is the embodiment of that transcendent no-thingness, spirit embodied in the real sense. And it manifests itself through all the limited, particular, finite, mortal things and experiences. These are tremendous mysteries, but you can experience them. Don't seek them. That is the one way to prevent the real experiencing. Let it happen. Be attentive, be mindful, be observant, with no grasping whatsoever, and therefore also no rejecting whatsoever, and the miracle will take place. Then the whole of life is one unbroken holiness. Transcendence itself is here. God walking on earth a while, a benediction to humanity. Humanity almost always, never knowing it, never seeing it. Then every action taking place through us, note, I don't say every action that we perform, but every action, every manifestation taking place through us is in true harmony with the divine creative process.